This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Yeah, well, it raises the question in a sense where it's like people are too... It's like maybe that's the challenge of, you know, we're talking about you got to learn your lessons here, like when you incarnate on the planet. Like maybe because the thing is like from the very beginning, it's like the whole thing is you just have to survive here, man, you know. And so it's like that's the lesson in a sense where it's like you're trying to figure this all out while also surviving. That's because if you just like ponder all this, it would be if everyone could search for enlightenment, it would be great. You know what I mean? But it's like there's all these obstacles in the way, it says.
Yeah, those obstacles you're talking about, I think that Buddhist mystics will call them Maya. And, you know, the distraction from the world, you know, and the world is full of wonderful distractions, you know. There are
Absolutely.
All sorts of delights to be tasted and, you know, and to be experienced. And obviously there's also a lot of pain and suffering, and there's a lot of a-holes out there that sure don't make it easy to try to survive into this world, like you say, you know. But I guess there are people who manage to realize, wait a minute, you know, this is just a game or part of the game. And maybe if you manage to realize that, it's maybe like, maybe it's after you play Super Mario enough times, you know, okay, you know, I know this is difficult, but I kind of like see the pattern, and I need to jump, strike.
I
do that, I get the power up, and I get the mushroom, and I get the princess. You know, there's this guy Anthony Peake. You know, he has this concept very.
Yeah, I know of Anthony Peake.
Yeah, the daemon and the eidolon, and the idea is the eidolon is us, right? Is us experiencing this world, but we are only avatars of this higher self that is also us, but is, you know, our higher self, and that is the daemon or the demon.
Yeah.
And the demon is in control of the eidolon, and from time to time, the demon will kind of like give hints to the eidolon, maybe because the daemon has played the game more than once, so that he knows, oh, if I go this way, I'm going to be, you know, killed by the machine gun that is in the video game.
So I'll try
to steer away this time, and that's why you sometimes do things that you don't understand why, you know, you suddenly have this rush of insight that seemingly comes from nowhere.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting. It's an interesting perspective on things. It's a very philosophical conversation we've had tonight.
Yeah, we're going deep, man.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it quite a bit. I hope I sound okay now. I'm like half paranoid.
Oh, you sound perfect.
All right.
Yeah, sounds perfect.
I think I'm getting a new phone this weekend, folks. It'll still be a Radio Shack phone if I can find a Radio Shack, but it'll at least be a new phone.
The Banal of America is brought to you by
Radio Shack. I almost don't want to like pivot from, you know what? Yeah, fuck the Tom DeLonge thing. Do you have anything to say about the Tom DeLonge thing? I kind of beat it to death last week. I just don't, you know. As you said before the show started, it's sort of this flavor of the month, but at the same time, it's now taking on the taste of gum you've been chewing for a long time, it seems.
Well, I don't know, man. I mean, it's been going around for some time, you know, I guess the last year or two, that he's been hinting of his encounters and his deals with people in the inside, quote unquote. And I guess that has always been like the poison apple of ufology. When someone attains a certain notoriety, and then it's offered this poisoned apple, and that is kind of like it appeals to your ego, right? When they come, when they contacted you, it means that you are important, right? And ego, man, ego is something that should be avoided at all costs. And I think that it was the doom of someone like Bill Moore, you know, when he was contacted by these people in the intelligence world after he published this book with Charles Berlitz about Roswell, and then someone called him and said, "We think that you are the only one who knows what he's talking about in this field." And Moore was very intelligent, but he was also, you know, someone that had a big ego, right? Like a lot of intelligent people tend to be, and that's how they hooked him, and that's how he agreed on that Faustian pact of, okay, you know, we are going to give you inside information about what the government knows about UFOs, and sometimes we're going to also give you disinformation, and it's going to be your work to try to figure out and discern which is which. And at the same time, if you want us to keep contacting you, you have to do our dirty work, which means from time to time, write reports about what people in your circles are doing, and also feeding people, those people in your circles, disinformation. You know, and that was the case of Bill Moore with Paul Benowitz. And at first, I thought that Tom DeLonge was going to be the second Paul Benowitz, but nowadays I feel that he's going to be more of a mixture between Bill Moore and someone like Stephen Greer, especially after his announcement of this To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, that, you know, the idea that, yeah, we're going to build a flying saucer and it's going to take us only 10 years and $1 billion, but we need your money.
Right.
And it was like, okay, you want my money, what do you have to show me? You know, and it was, back then it was, okay, a bunch of guys who worked in government and said, yeah, UFOs are totally real, man. You know what, we've had those kind of insiders before come, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Come out and say, yeah, UFOs are real and the government is interested in them. That is not enough to make a corporation, and that is not a product you can sell.
Yeah, yeah.
In my humble opinion,
it's like diminishing returns in a sense. Because I mean, how many? I'd like someone out there to make a list of like all of the government insiders that have. I mean, it's got to be in the hundreds, probably. It's got to be over 100. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when it was like scandalous or something, where it was like a guy could get a book out of that kind of thing. Like, what was the day after Roswell guy? You know? Now it's like government. Now you don't even know these government insiders by name or anything, because there's so many.
Yeah, remember there was this guy. What was his name? Chase something. He used to be in the FBI, right? And he was kind of like a liaison between the FBI and Hollywood. And I guess he, you know, make news like 4 or 5 years ago when he said, yeah, I was in this office and I looked into this box that said Roswell and I saw all this evidence, you know, about the bodies and about the crash and all of that. And instead of, oh, my God, this is so huge, it was like, meh.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, theoretically, that's the kind of thing we dreamed about, and then it happens, and it's like, no one really, it didn't change the world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that it's this kind of thing that some people were waiting for disclosure, you know, like, 10, 20 years ago, I was one of them, you know. I have to admit it.
For sure, yeah.
You know? I mean, but you learn, Tim. I mean, you learn about, you have to learn about false promises. I remember I was 25 years ago, I was still in, it was the 90s, right? So it was back when we still had this huge UFO wave over Mexico and all of that. And I remember that I went to this UFO conference. You know, there was a few people that make the news back in those ways. It was Pedro Ferriz. I don't think Maussan was there. No, definitely not. But there was a guy who used to appear in the same TV programs as Maussan. He claimed to be a contactee. And at one point, he demanded a microphone because he said that he had a message to deliver, you know, from the aliens, that he said he was authorized to say that the aliens would make a huge appearance on the skies of Mexico on exactly New Year's Eve of that year, you know. And we were like in late November or early December, right? So it was really very close. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, it's finally going to happen. And I remember that night, you know, when my family went to the house of one of my uncles where we had this huge New Year's party, you know, with all of my relatives in Mexico. But where was I? I was on the rooftop of that house trying to finally catch my first, you know, UFO sighting, freezing my ass off, but determined, you know, to finally see it. And I remember my mother saying, aren't you going to come down? I was like, no, I need to stay here. You know, I need to steal my resolve. You know, and finally, you know, it was 2 or 3 in the morning, and my parents said, yeah, we're going to go. If you want to stay here, you know, ask your uncles, you know, so you can, you know, dream. You can go and sleep in one of their couches or something. I was like, no, let's go. So bottom line is there's been promises of, you know, arrival of aliens, of the Space Brothers, and there's been promise of disclosure, like, forever. I mean, I remember when Stephen Bassett used to still say that Obama was going to be the disclosure president.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
He was saying, oh, no, just like the day before he walks out of the White House, he's going to say, oh, by the way, you aliens are real, you know, drop the mic and run.
yeah, exactly. Well, it makes you wonder if, like, I don't want to get into the politics of it, but it makes you wonder in a sense, because there seem to be, like, again, we use sort of the zeitgeist idea, but it's like there's a real push for disclosure last year, but it all hinged on Hillary Clinton. And now it almost makes you wonder if, like, the disclosure hive mind is having, like, an existential crisis. And it's like someone going through a middle age crisis. They wind up with Tom DeLonge. You know, is that what's going on with the disclosure thing, where it's like, okay, well, our big plan for the government, it didn't work out, so now let's pivot to a celebrity be the one that will be able to do it for us.
I kind of suspect, and I'm sure you are suspecting it too, Tim, that those hopes about official government disclosure are going to be revived this very week, and it's going to happen by
JFK
Thursday, files. Yeah, because of the JFK files, because of the all this hoopla that Trump, well, he didn't allow the files to be released, but he didn't obstruct it either,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, so I guess that's going to be interesting, you know, and everybody who has managed those files say there are not really a lot of bombs or really incendiary material for conspiracy theorists, but there are still a lot of interesting things for people who do their due homework and really connect the dots.
That's what
for
I
example,
think, because, yeah, I've heard the same thing where it's like the people that know what's in them, they're like, there's no smoking gun, but it's like, there's no way, I find it hard to believe, I hope, I guess, that the people who say that, they're like, no, I'm hoping that there's like, that they pale in comparison to the JFK obsessives. Who will find some nugget in there that's like, oh shit, I found the dot that connects the whole thing that I, you know, that's kind of the hope, right? But who knows?
Yeah. By the way, I remember like 2 days ago, reading on Facebook someone sharing a post by none other than Uri Geller, right?
Yeah, I think I saw that. I remember a little bit of it. Yeah.
And this famous or infamous psychic or charlatan, according to where you stand, is that he said that he suspected that with this new release of information, his true role in the JFK case was going to be finally released, and that it will be shown that he was working for the CIA as being an undercover agent in Mexico. And I was reading that like, what?
Yeah.
I know that Geller was somehow involved with people in high places down here in Mexico. I think that he befriended one of the presidents here. I think was Echeverria. And I also, I think that he became the lover of one of the president's wives.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. And I think that he promised them that he will find oil wells for them, you know, for our national oil industry, Pemex, using his quote-unquote powers.
Wow. And never heard of this stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so what they did is they would, you know, put him on a plane, and you know, and they will be flying around places where there might be oil deposits, and he will just like wave his hands, and they put an X on a map and say, "Yeah, it's real here." And I don't know if people in my country were so gullible. Sometimes I suspect it, but they totally believed him, and they were very happy with him. And he brags that one of the presidents of Mexico, either Echeverria or José López Portillo, the guy who came after him, that they gave him the Mexican citizenship, which is really very unheard of. You know, I mean, becoming a citizen of Mexico is not as easy as becoming a citizen of the United States. You know, and so there is this connection with Uri Geller and Mexico and the CIA that Geller thinks that is going to be revealed with this new release of information.
Oh, wow.
But I don't know if that is true or not, but one thing for certain, Jim, is that I think that people who are interested in the whole JFK case should pay more attention to what transpired in Mexico back in those days. You know, remember even in Oliver Stone's movie, there was just a single like 2-5 seconds in the movie where they show a photo and one of the assistants of these the guy who put the people who were allegedly involved with the murder, Garrison. You know, one of Garrison's assistants saying, "Yeah, no, the CIA is telling us that this man," and they show a picture, was Oswald in Mexico, so, like trying to make the argument that it was a double, that it was not the real Oswald. But some people are saying no, that Oswald did come to Mexico, and the reason that why he came is because he wanted to get in contact with agents from the Cuban government, and apparently he did so. And apparently he told them that he was going to murder the president.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, and the Cubans, you know, they didn't say anything. Like, we don't know if they returned to Cuba to alert Castro, and we don't know what Castro did with that information, whether he alerted, you know, his Russian allies or not. You know, he didn't alert you know, the American authorities, you know, but probably wasn't in his best interest, although he could have, you know, maybe he would say, you know, hey, this is like a branch of goodwill, you know. Maybe if he had done so and someone had also tried to do something about it, maybe, you know, Kennedy would have lifted the embargo.
Yeah, it makes you wonder in a sense, like maybe the... Because the embargo always seemed kind of illogical to have lasted so long. So maybe it was like this unspoken thing where it's like, you knew this was going to happen and you didn't do anything about it. Or at least there's some kind of cloud of suspicion almost that always seemed to hang over the island there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember reading this interview between a reporter and Fidel Castro. And apparently this is a guy that Castro liked a lot. So he had interviewed Castro on numerous occasions. Like, he was one of his favorite reporters.
Right, right.
And in one of his latest interviews, maybe his last interview with him, the reporter asked him about Kennedy. And Castro said that, you know, even though all the problems with the Bay of Pigs, that he respected Kennedy as a person, you know, as an individual. And he kind of like seemed obsessed with the death of Kennedy, because the next day, you know, or the day when they kind of like continue the interview, Castro mentioned Kennedy and his assassination once again, you know, kind of like out of the blue, which kind of like makes you wonder how much did Castro really know about the assassination plot.
One would think he had to know a lot, or
mm-hmm.
at least a lot more than you and I know. So
mm-hmm.
it'll be interesting to see if that kind of information comes out. I mean, who knows? There's got to be some stuff in there that's very interesting. You know what I'm saying? It's not just like shitty paperwork, I assume. So, and I believe one of the sort of things that one of the big things is the file on Oswald in Mexico. I could have sworn I heard that, but I'm not positive.
Mm-hmm. I think that people who are interested into this sort of stuff should pay more attention into that. It's probably one of the things that we will hear more about in the coming weeks, you know, once they release the files and, you know, people start to really get into that. And then probably, you know, the real serious investigators will obviously take a while to digest
right.
all of it, you know, because I think there are thousands and thousands of pages, you know. So obviously, you know, amateurs will get tired of it soon enough. But those who really know what they're doing, you know, they will take the one and they'll start to release you know, the important or the interesting bits, you know, into the internet, and that's when we will start to maybe know more. What I remember that some people say that maybe one of the reasons why Trump decided to not block the release of the files is because he wanted to see if Ted Cruz's father was actually involved. He was one of the assassins.
Oh my God. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, it'll be kind of like an interesting, as you said, if we talk about disclosure, it's probably like the closest to sort of like a faux disclosure we'll ever see, we may see, you know, in a sense. Because it'll be interesting to me, I think, and I read this in an article about sort of what may happen when these things get released, kind of what you said, where there's so much stuff that it's hard, it's going to be like impossible really for the media to digest it right away, but at the same time, they're going to be on such pressure to get it out there that they'll sort of spin some narratives out of these files right away. And it'll be interesting
yeah.
to see what those narratives are. And one would assume that they don't necessarily come from, like, some intern who is reading all the files as soon as they get released, but it's like maybe someone on the inside is like, make sure you check out this specific file that mentions Ted Cruz's father or something, you know, or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see. I feel like this is going to be, I wouldn't say orchestrated, but I think like there'll be a certain sort of like, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Let's put it that way. You know what I mean?
Because
mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to like come out, the thing's going to come out and the media's going to be like, okay, this proves that there was a conspiracy. You know what I mean? If anything, it's going to be the opposite. You know, they're going to be like, this was it. This was the Holy Grail. You got it. And now it, you know, you've had 3 hours to look at it. So, all right, guess it didn't solve the mystery, you know? So
yeah.
It's like 3 hours, what are you talking about? We're going to need months to look at this stuff, but that'll be the thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember that when we, team, went last year to Dallas, you know?
Yeah,
we went
yeah.
to the place where all of this happened. It, to me, was a really, really, really interesting experience. I never thought that I would be able to actually visit the place. And then we went to the book depository, and it gave me some perspective. I mean, I was a guy who watched the JFK movie by Oliver Stone, like, I don't know, 10, 20 times, you know, just back and to the left, back and to the left. And once we went there, it changed my perspective in the sense that, you know, yeah, there was obviously a conspiracy. I don't think that Oswald acted alone, but I really suspect that he was involved in it. He wasn't just a patsy. I think that he was, there on top of that book depository, and he did fire that rifle, you know. And I don't know if he managed to hit Kennedy or not. And also, I think that there probably were other people in place. I mean, I remember being there, and I say it's not that impossible of a shot. I think, I mean, when you see it in the movies and you see it from outside, and then you go and visit the place and see how, you know,
how
small
close you are.
It is,
yeah.
You know, it gives you another sense, and the idea that yeah, it could have been done, and maybe even, you know, the same thing with the back and to the left. You know, the idea that okay, the final hit came from, you know, in front Kennedy, right? But you see the magnifications of the Zapruder film, and you start to question it because you see how the I don't want to get too graphic here, but the result of the impact and see how the president's head, it's opened like a cantaloupe, and then the jerking movement to the back, I don't know if some people have considered the possibility that it was the result of President Kennedy wearing a corset, you know. I don't think that many people realized he was such a sick, feeble man. He suffered from terrible back pains.
Yeah.
And when he went to public appearances, he was always using a back corset because that's the only way that he could stand being, you know, standing for so long. And I think that maybe having something stiff, you know, beneath his suit and his shirt, maybe that could account for that weird jerking movement instead of the impact from in front. But having said that, you know, obviously there are things about the way that it was presented in the, you know, what's the name of that, the official investigation.
Oh, the Warren Commission?
The Warren Commission, yeah. I mean, things like the pristine bullet that was found, you know, next to the president in the hospital. That was like, get out of here, you know. That bullet couldn't have possibly have entered the body of a human being and left out of it in such a pristine condition. That's just impossible.
Right, right. Well, it makes you think. I mean, yeah, I think there were definitely the whole idea that he was just hanging around on his own doing this is like the part that's unbelievable, I think, to most
yeah,
people.
Could
he have been in on it? Like the idea that he was just some dude with who happened, like he was clearly somehow mixed up in some trouble that day. Let's put it that way, you know.
Yeah.
Like clearly he was had some kind of bad ideas.
My suspicion team is that he was a double agent, that he was left. He was led to defect to Russia because he was going to inform the government or the CIA about the Russians, and then he was allowed to return to the United States because of that double agent work. You know, that's the only explanation. Otherwise, he should have gone into jail for being a traitor, right?
Right, I've heard that before, too, where it's like, there's no way, yeah, yeah, he renounced his citizenship and everything. They shouldn't have just let him come back and just go back and move to Texas or whatever.
So one of the things that we're probably going to hear about Tim in the next few months, and I've already read about it, is that when people investigate Oswald's trip into Mexico, that they're going to learn that the Mexican authorities informed the Americans of the fact that Oswald was, you know, meeting Cuban agents. You know, that because the Mexican government was well aware of his being here and his meetings, and you know, Mexican agents were on his tail, and Mexico being an ally of the United States, you know, they reported that to someone there. And I think that what's going to transpire is that the CIA didn't inform the FBI about just how severe this was, you know, the fact that this radical was meeting with Cuban agents. They didn't want to alert them of the fact that they knew of Oswald because he was one of their double agents, because they didn't want to let the FBI and other agencies know about all of that. So, in other words, what we're going to really uncover, my suspicion about this conspiracy is that it was more of a conspiracy of silence because of this, you know, unwillingness to cooperate between different factions of the U.S. government. And this is also my stance with things like 9/11, that my opinion is that with 9/11, it was more of a showing that the CIA doesn't really want to cooperate with the FBI, and the FBI doesn't want to cooperate with the Air Force, and the Air Force doesn't want to cooperate with the military. You know, conspiracy theorists tend to think of the government as this monolithic entity.
Right,
you know,
right. It's actually like very faction.
Exactly. Everybody is in their clique, and everybody is acting on their best interest. And the Air Force wants to get the big contract, you know.
Yeah.
For their new weapon, and the CIA is the ones to want to have the biggest budget instead of the NSA. So, I think that is what's going to happen with JFK too. That we're going to learn that the CIA didn't want to share what they knew about Oswald with the FBI and other authorities, and that's why, you know, then it happened what it happened, and they want to cover it up.
Interesting. Well, we'll see. The crazy part, though, is like, it's the old idea of like, well, if they announce the UFOs are real, like, it doesn't change the way, it doesn't change the price of bread. So it's like, it'll be interesting to see. It'll matter to you and me, but it's like, it'll be interesting to see how people react, I guess is the point, is what I'm sort of putting out there, you know, where it's like, how will they even care? Will it be like so long ago that, you know, or will like open their eyes to something that they, because I mean, there's already sort of this pushback again. I think that like part of the reason why this is getting released now is because there's this factional war going on with like the intelligence agencies in general. So it's like, if something will embarrass them, then the, let's say the federal government's more, the president's more than happy to do that. So who knows? You know, this may turn out to be even bigger in a sense where it could be like scandalous, and then it could get spun that way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've heard about DeLong is that the reason why he is being groomed or he's being contacted by these people in the intelligence world is because it's one avenue to try to once again attain respectability by the public. You know, nowadays everybody despises the CIA. You know, they think that the CIA is watching them every time they're jerking off in front of their laptop, you know, watching porn, you know, and they're reading all of their dirty emails, you know, and they're keeping all of that in a vault in Nevada, or actually in Utah is where they keep all these records. But some people have said that DeLong is being used in order to try to show the intelligence world as acting up in the public's best interest, because you know they were keeping this secret for a reason, right? And the whole idea with DeLong actually is because, you know, they discover nasty things about the aliens and that they're not really that good and all of that. I don't know, but one thing's for certain, Tim, is that JFK is not UFOs. People may read pages, you know, words written on a page that mentions names and dates and locations. And with the JFK, they could say, okay, this is proof enough that so-and-so was involved, or that so-and-so knew about X and that, X and Y.
Yeah.
But with UFOs, if you give me a piece of paper that said, yeah, there was a landing on December 21st, 1957, that, to me, is not enough. And it shouldn't be to anyone. So that's the problem with Tom DeLonge right now. I mean, he had a group of people going in front of a video with no one to refute or to ask them questions and saying, yeah, UFOs are real. Dude, so what? I mean, give me evidence. And Leslie King on his Facebook page that's saying, look, folks, this is as close as disclosure as we have been in a long, long time. And I remember tweeting something to Leslie saying, sorry, Leslie, but in a post-fact world, saying that is not enough. You have to show evidence.
Right.
And in the case of the utopic UFO disclosure, I don't know what kind of evidence you could show that would convince people. What,
it would have to be like a live and in living color piece of evidence. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Even documents are like worthless now. So it's
documents are worthless.
Photos and videos.
Photographs are worthless. I mean, in the last week,
we established that insiders are really kind of worthless at this point. So it's, you know, unless it's like Jimmy Carter, even then they'd be like, oh, he's got dementia. Or something, you know what I mean? It's like nothing's good enough even in that realm. It seems.
Even if tomorrow Donald Trump went and tweeted, yeah, UFOs are real and I've seen them, you know, they showed me the files, half of America and half of the world will not believe him.
yeah, exactly. And we still wouldn't know anything. That's the real, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, even if they tell us, the quest for them to, it's like you're on a cheat or something, you know. It's like the quest for them to tell us they're real doesn't solve any of the mysteries.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean,
it just sort of establishes that there's a game. And we know there's a game. The game is what are the fucking UFOs?
Yeah, but the reality of UFOs to us, team, is like stage one of this whole wacky journey, right?
Right.
We embarked and we, you know, learned and read and came to a conclusion, you know, informal conclusion, I would care to say that, hey, there is something to all of this, you know. This is something that has legs, right? Probably most people don't reach that far, but that's stage one in this wacky journey.
Right.
And then you embark in stage two with kind of kind of pointless in the sense that you start to wonder, well, where do they come from, you know?
Yeah.
And most of the time you say, well, of course they come from other planets, right? You know, they come from another star system, another galaxy, and then you enter the ETH Hall of Mirrors.
Right.
And most people never get out of it, you know, because it's kind of like a maze, you know, with a
pretty
lot
much,
of gates.
Yeah, that's what they're keeping the general public in the ETH Hall of Mirrors.
And then the idea is that one way to get out of that Hall of Mirrors, you know, is by stopping to question where they come from and started to make more interesting to questions like, what are they doing here? And that is something that Vallée teaches us in his books, in Passport to Magonia. It's like, let's stop, battling or arguing about whether UFOs come from this planet or that other star, and let's start to pay attention what of the influence the UFO phenomenon has in our culture, you know, and that's the whole basis of Passport to Magonia and the idea of you know, the showing how this phenomenon has evidence of being with us through the folklore we have about, you know, the Celtic myths, the faith in fairies in Ireland and Britain, and also in other places, yeah, Greece, even here in Mexico. Every ancient culture has their own myths about encountering non-human entities, you know, how we deal with them and how they interact with us and all of that. So he starts to pay attention to that. And if you go into the same path, then you start to open yourself to other avenues. And then you realize that, you know, this ETH Hall of Mirrors is kind of boring. You know, it's kind of small too. Let's go into more interesting avenues, and then you start to go into the idea that, well, you know, UFOs may be interdimensional, or maybe they're time travelers, and the whole point of that start to expanding your horizons into more and more interesting ideas, and it's kind of like a spiritual path in a way. I mean, Mike Leland, who was one of my the collaborators in UFOs Reframing the Debate, he once wrote in his blog that, you know, the UFO path, that you start with light in the sky, and sooner or later, if you do the work well enough, you start to wonder about God. You know, it's kind of inevitable in a way.
Yeah. Well, that's, I agree. I think a lot of the circles that we travel in a lot of the same circles, and that's kind of like, yeah, once you've reached an endpoint on the ETH where,
yeah,
you've beaten it into the ground. Now, we've crossed over the Rubicon to the live off the live show. Can we talk for a little while longer?
Sure.
All right. I wore out poor Aaron Gullius last week. I felt like a dick, so I push it. How's the sound now? Am I coming in?
Perfect.
All right? All right.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, folks listening, I'll try and make sure it sounds okay relatively on that first part. But yeah, this is a deeply much. I really had no notes when we came into this conversation, so it's like I really enjoy talking to you because it gets into this like sort of philosophical realm that that I didn't anticipate really. But it's good. As I said, I mean, I must have sensed it because as I was introducing you, you know, I mentioned this sort of like there's a wisdom here of pondering these big questions. Because in a way, it's like even like you were saying, like at some point asking like you move on from like, are they real or not? It's like whatever's real, whatever. There's legs,
yeah,
to it. Like you said, there's legs to it. So you move past that. And then the next thing is like, where do they come from? It's like at some point you have to move past that question. Because it's like where they come from really doesn't answer too much either, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, so they come from Venus. So what? like what? Again, it's like what you said. What the fuck are they doing here? Like, why are they coming here? What is going on? You know, or why is this intelligence interacting with us? You know, it might be a completely terrestrial phenomenon. As crazy as it sounds.
Yeah. It could totally be, you know. I mean, L. Miles Lewis, you know, one of the contributors of UFOs Reframing the Debate, you know, in his essay entertains partially the idea that maybe the UFO phenomenon is some kind of a manifestation of a Gaia consciousness. In other ways, it's, a superhuman or supernatural consciousness that emanates from the planet itself, you know, getting to the idea that, well, okay, so what if a planet is as conscious as we are? It's just that we just don't realize, the same way that maybe a cell that is part of our body doesn't realize, if it was conscious, that it is part of a larger whole. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like a system itself has like a...
Yeah,
you know, it's like it's not necessarily has a conscious, but it's living. You know, even
mm-hmm.
like a motor is, you know,
mm-hmm.
is like alive in a sense. Cause, you know, when your car breaks down, the engine's dead. You know, it's like
mm-hmm.
same kind of idea.
Yeah, I mean, and we can talk about, you know, some people that discusses these sort of things. They arrive to some kind of like panpsychism. Or The idea that everything is kind of like infused with consciousness in a way, you know,
yeah.
that consciousness permeates everything in the universe, that consciousness is the basis of reality. But getting back to the Gaia thing, that makes sense in a way for explaining not only UFO sightings, you know, and all those Space Brothers who were warning us about, you know, they don't play with matches, folks. You know,
yeah,
you know don't play with those nuclear matches because you are going to burn down the whole house. You know, it will make sense if the planet is trying to kind of resisting our attempts to destroy it, you know, and in the same way to try to coax us to leave the nest once and for all and venture into the stars. And that's why it chooses to show itself in the way of technology. We can try to kind of like understand, you know, even though it's supposedly more advanced than us, but it is interesting, yeah, that those flying saucers in the 50s and 60s, you know, they looked like, you know, Star Trek in the 1960s, you know,
right, exactly.
There was all these dials and buttons and lights, and nowadays you see the reboot of Star Trek right now, the Star Trek Discovery, and you see the new ship, and it is far more futuristic than the original Star Trek, you know? So now, obviously, when people go into, you know, the flying saucer, when they get abducted, they probably see a more futuristic version of an iPad, you know, now
yeah,
in the hands of a Nordic alien or something like that. And also, you know, there are also the Marian apparitions, you know, the apparitions of what the witnesses interpret as the Virgin Mary, you know, and they happen in places that where people in ancient times used to worship, you know, the goddess, you know, Mother Nature. You know, and they used to put altars there, and it's always the same kind of places. You know, there are like caves or places where there's running water. You know, like running beneath it. You know, so we go now into the idea of the dragon lines, of the ley lines, of these lines of energy that are traversing the whole of the planet, kind of like an energy circulatory system for the world. And the idea of a Gaia consciousness makes sense in that way. Obviously, like everything in the UFO phenomenon, I don't think there's a one theory that can connect all of the dots.
Right,
you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
There are things that the Gaia theory explains really well, but there are other things that it may not. You know,
yeah, well, I mean, I've likened this to sort of like weather and or clouds in a sense where it's
mm-hmm,
like there's
mm-hmm.
all different types and shapes and formations of clouds, but they're all part of some kind of same system. So it's
yep.
like, you know, and back in the day, they used to look up at them and not know how the hell they were made or what what they, you know, what their nature was at all, you know.
Cool. And now we can affect the clouds in a way, you know, and we have things in the planes and that can create contrails, right? And people say, oh, my God, what are those? And the people reach different conclusions about those. But what I'm saying is we may also be influencing the phenomenon in a way, right? It may be reacting to us.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And to our civilization.
I definitely think it is. I think it has to be. You know, almost in a sense where, you know, you talk about like the observer effect where it's like it needs us as much as we need it. You know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's, but what it needs, who knows, you know, but I think, yeah, I don't think we'll ever really know the answer to these like intense philosophical type, you know, like is the earth conscious or like a living thing? You know what I mean? Like we'll someday learn them maybe in the next realm, but it's
mm-hmm.
like. But I think the point is to. We talked about this Buddha thing earlier. It's like I think the point is to ask these questions. You know.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's why a lot of us sort of gravitate toward each other and have this community in a sense where it's like we're the only people asking these like these really sort of deep questions when everyone else is like wrapped up with the Kardashians and shit.
I think it's part of growing old, Tim. You know, I mean, I think that when you are younger, you really think that you are going to get all the answers, you know, eventually. And
yeah.
You know, part of maturity is to learn that it's okay if you never actually go and figure shit out. You know, it's okay to not have everything answered for. You know, I mean, obviously it's nice if you manage to something a few things down. You know, I mean, hey, I'm all up for, you know, someone like your friend Adam Davies discovering some weird undiscovered ape, you know,
in some
jungle out there. You know, that will be really, really cool. I'm really will be content if someone discovers some really ancient remain of a very advanced city in some, you know, desert, or maybe underwater, you know, maybe like in the shores of Cuba or whatever, you know. And so, look, you know, these guys were really, really advanced, and they were here like 40,000 years old or 50,000 years old, you know. And a few other things, you know, that I think that one of the things that probably I'm rooting for more than disclosure, definitely, is that our science could confirm that consciousness is non-local, right? That is not constrained or is not created by the brain. To me, that will be far more important than Tom DeLonge showing us, you know, some weird piece of metal saying, yeah, look, this came from the Roswell crash. Because because the non-locality of consciousness opens up a whole new can of worms, you know, because it will make us think about phenomena and mysteries like precognition and synchronicities, you know, and even reincarnation and telepathy and all of that, you know, and prophetic dreams and all of that. And that is one of the aspects that I also think that Tom DeLonge and his ilk are not talking about. I mean, it was two nuts and bolts. You know, the idea, yeah, let's only focus on the technology. Well, you know, cool. You want to build a vacuum energy toroidal electromagnetic vessel that can traverse the Earth in 1.5 milliseconds. Good for you, bro. But I want to know about whether I can, you know, with my consciousness, connect with the other part of the universe, or can connect with my ancestor who lived, 200 or 5,000 years ago, or maybe if I can connect with my descendants in the far, far future, or maybe even better, if another aspect of the multiverse. You know, what about that?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I wonder if they. You talked about earlier this movie that was about. They figured out what happens after life, after death. One of my favorite sort of like thought experiments was sort of that idea when talking to Rosemary Ellen Gallagher on the show, where it was like, maybe the government, maybe this UFO thing is just kind of a big distraction in a way from like the real meat of it all, where it's like you are gods. Like everyone has these abilities, but we don't want you to know that you can access them. You know,
that's a very good point. I mean, maybe the UFO phenomenon, it's just meant to nudge us in the right direction from time to time, you know. They're trying to say, you know, you monkeys, look over here, you know.
Right.
But what we are like the dog that is looking at the finger, but the finger is pointing at something. Well, yeah, now the dog is looking at the finger because it doesn't understand. Yeah, look over there, my dog.
Yeah, well, it's... I mean, this is why we chase after these things, man, because it's like there's something going on, you know? There's something going on, and it's fascinating. And it's... I think, like, as you get closer to to trying to, like, as you get deeper into it, it just becomes really enveloping in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you got a good head on your shoulders because you're not like one of these crazy people that's like some people go off the deep end. I feel I feel bad for them. You know, it's like you have to have one foot in reality still, unfortunately, because it's like we're in the minority of people who are looking at this, like, you know, as a series of dots or whatever.
Well, I think that there's always that danger for sure. You know, the UFO is a slippery slope. You know, all of these topics are like, you know, the proverbial rabbit hole.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you do can get too deep, and, you know, you need to have some kind of like a lifeline, you know, to try to see, okay, you know, the go back, you know, you have spelunking, you have spelunked enough. Now it's time to go and do other stuff, because there are other aspects of life that one shouldn't miss out. You know, maybe that's one of the reasons why, you know, these mysteries are so elusive, but because they don't want us to get so obsessed with them. You know, there are other aspects of life that one should explore, and there you have also to keep you grounded by way of arming yourself with a good group of you know, peers and colleagues that can tell hey, man, you know, I think that you're losing it. I think that now you're really talking bullshit here. You know, I mean, where's your evidence for this? You know, I mean, yeah, you think that the long is actually a secret reptilian.
Oh God,
that something like that. But okay, so are you sure about that? You know, or maybe you've been, you know, looking at those blacked out, you know, documents for too long. You know, maybe you should go and get some air and get a beer.
Yeah.
And talk about other stuff aside from UFOs.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, for sure. Because I lost my train of thought there, but yeah. Your mention of beer got my mind racing here. Well, actually, here's something. All right, so what's the website where people can check out the stuff? AbsurdByDesign.com, right? And you got a shirt now you want folks to pick up because it would help you out, and that's something new from you, Absurd by Design. You're going to start doing more shirts. You got to do my legalized gray marriage idea, dude. I'm telling you.
Yeah, eventually. Actually, right now I have two shirts. You know, there's the Absurd by Design logo, you know, with the goblin, you know, sticking his tongue. And there's also one for Mothman and John Keel fans. You know, now that's the 1967 anniversary.
Oh, I saw that picture you did. Yeah. Okay, so that's on a shirt now?
Yeah, it's a shirt, and I think I've shown it to a few people, and they liked it, and I think that, you know, it's an interesting homage to John Keel. You know, I show him as a man in white, a man in white instead of a man in black, and he has a fire, you know, torch, you know, a flamethrower, you know, and he's like giving a huge torch to Mothman and says, "Mothman, kill it with fire." But Keel is like, instead of a K-I-L-L, is K-E-E-L, you know.
Nice.
So yeah, the idea is to try to make this kind of stuff, you know. I mean, I want to try to portray my culture, your culture, 14 culture, just as, you know, as hip and as enjoyable and something to be proud of, the same way that geeks, you know, managed to do with their own culture. You know, I mean, the 30 years ago or 25 years ago, if you walked outside the door with a superhero a T-shirt, you were going to probably get beaten, you know, and get bullied.
Made fun of,
you know?
Made fun of, yeah.
Yeah, they will call you nerd.
Yeah, exactly.
And now it's totally cool. I want to do the same thing.
It's really weird, and it's interesting, because I remember, like, sort of learning this from one of Stan's books, Stan Friedman. I think it was, like, I forget the name of the book, but it was, like, his seminal UFO book that came out after the after the MJ-12 one and the Roswell one. But he sort of like laid out this sort of like he detailed about how these different three prominent one sci-fi writers like hated UFOs and everything, and it's like you almost see it in a sense where it's like this weird like sci-fi is cool now,
yeah.
But UFOs still the whole paranormal and the more even UFOs because like Bigfoot's cool and ghosts are cool, but like UFOs are still. They're not really. They just don't have that cool cachet that even Bigfoot and ghosts have somehow managed to achieve. So it's
it's like
a weird sci-fi. I think it's like a sci-fi bias in a sense. I mean,
yeah,
that's what it seemed to be back in the day.
It's a social stigma. Still, you know, the idea that you into that kind of stuff. You know, the irony about it is that we all are. You know, I remember. One of those occasions I went to the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis, you know, and you go to, you know, the customs, you know, through customs, you know, once you get to the United States and they ask you, you know, what's the reason of your visit?
I always told
the truth. I'm going to, the Paradigm Symposium. What is that? You know, well, it's a symposium, a conference in which we talk about ancient aliens and UFOs and, you know, ancient civilizations, you know. And the guy, you know, then looked at me for a moment and said, oh, are you into that kind of stuff? And I was expecting to, you know, be mocked at, you know, smirked at, you know, even worse, you know, for a second I thought, you know, maybe the guy will
send you back.
deny my entrance to the United States. But no, you know, all of a sudden the guy was telling me about his own UFO sighting, you know, next to the border, and he was saying, oh yeah, and I was seeing these silvery objects going from there to there, you know, and 2 minutes later I was saying, okay sir, but can you please stamp my passport because I have places to go, people to meet. So the thing is that, you know, in a way, it's interesting, you know, we're talking about ghost shows and the reason that they're still so popular, and it's probably because, you know, there was a recent survey by some university, American university, and they made a survey and they learned that there's a huge percentage of the population, like, I don't know, 30-something percent that believe that places can be haunted by spirits. It's even bigger, the percentage, than people who believe that either aliens visited the Earth in the ancient past or are still coming to this planet. You know, so that tells you something that, you know, ghosts to Americans are bigger than UFOs. And in a very, very small percentage, Bigfoot, you know, was, you know, part of that survey, you know. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Bigfoot fans. But I want to try to see how we can get rid of that stigma because I think it's social, you know.
Definitely, yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, it's the ultimate social closet. You know, the idea that, yeah, you are into that kind of stuff, and I like to read books about UFOs and ghosts and cryptids and whatnot. It's kind of like in the 1980s when you know, were afraid to admit that you were gay, you know, and look what has happened in the last 25, 30 years, you know. I mean, that's one of the reasons why probably we'll end up, you know, making you legalize gay marriage, you know, eventually, because in a way it pares down those two stigmas quite nicely, you know.
Yeah, well, I stole it from Jeremy Vaney, but I've given it to you, so it's been passed down.
Yeah,
I think it's very clever. I just found it very like. It's like almost like a weird sort of like disclose, but in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Like the government should announce that.
Yeah, but first I need to make for Robbie and Greg and myself, you know, the fuck disclosure T-shirt that they can wear when they go to next year to the International UFO Conference. Robbie Graham is going to be one of the speakers. So it will be really cool if he, you know, wears that kind of T-shirt, you know, in front of, you know, someone like, I don't know, Stephen Bassett or even Uncle Stan. You know, I wonder what he would think. You know,
I think Stan will laugh, but
yeah, I think so. I think so.
Stan will laugh. Now, this is good in a sense because I get to hit you with the question that everyone gets me at. So it's like, when are you going to write a book? Have you thought about writing a book? Mm. What's the timetable on the book?
Well,
what's going on? You know, have you considered writing a book? You know, it seems like you have a lot of deep thoughts on a lot of other things. So you're kind of like me in a sense where it's like, I don't really know exactly what I want to write. You know what I mean?
I think I'm in that avenue or that category team. I mean, if you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I would have told you, no way. No, it's not in my plans, you know, at all. But last year when Robbie approached me and said, hey, I'm going to edit this anthology about UFOs, and you are one of the people that I want to be involved in this project, that you, will you be interested in, you know, writing an essay for it? I find myself, you know, not acting like my usual, you know, woozy self and say, no, no way. You know, I said, you know what? Yeah, let's see if I can come up with something. You know, I remember I asked him, you know, but I really don't know if I have something original to say. And he said, no, I think you do. I asked him if we could Skype together. I wanted to pitch some ideas to him and started talking about, you know, these ideas I had about UFOs being like a symbol for anarchy and its social implication, and said, yeah, that's perfect, you know. So write an essay, a 7,000 word essay about that. And obviously, first you have the idea. Okay, cool. It's the starting point, you know. Otherwise, you have nothing. And then you try to do a bit of research and to try to connect the dots, you know, connect these, because you start having all these ideas that are really not connected, and then trying to make a sense of them and try to follow like a path, you know, from going to point A to, you know, point C of what I want to say after that, and actually make it something that people will bother to read, you know, which is easier said than done. It's really, you know, writing is one of the most difficult enterprises one could do, you know. I mean, I don't consider myself to be a writer, you know, even though I have written for blogs for several years now, and now this was the first time that I, you know, wrote something that was, you know, published in a book. And a 7,000 word essay, I guess, is equivalent to a chapter, right? Or maybe it will be a chapter and a half, depending on just how long you want them to be. So once I got a taste of that, I realized, well, yeah, maybe this I could do, you know, if I could have a really, really good idea and I could get someone like Robbie, you know, to like guide me, you know, be my editor and help me out once I, you know, if I get stuck into trying to put my ideas together. But like you said, you know, I feel that I need something really original and really unique to say. You know, I actually felt once I wrote that essay, anarchy in the UFO, let's say, okay, you know, that I ran out of things to say about UFOs, you know, for the time being.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we're on the same page, no pun intended, in a sense, where it's like, I have a bunch of different ideas, so I don't know what the hell I have to eventually settle on sort of one avenue. But
yeah, I mean, my friend Micah Hanks, you know, our friend Micah Hanks, we've talked about trying to maybe co-author a book, you know, together, which would be probably a better avenue for me, you know, that instead of, you know, just embarking on a book all by my own. I remember when we were pitching, you know, maybe the idea of trying to write something about the mystery of Friendship Island, which is something that is not really that not known, that well known in English-speaking UFO circles. This idea of there's this island in almost next to Antarctica, you know, in Chile, you know,
yeah.
This place called the Chonos Archipelago. That's kind of like almost like the island in the series Lost, which, by the way, I managed to finish quite recently, and I have to say I like the ending, even, you know. But this idea that there is this island where there's some kind of like Dharma initiative, kind of like secret society,
yeah,
that are in contact with aliens, and that they have all these advanced technology, and they're pretty much waiting for our civilization to collapse so they can pick up the pieces and start over again. So that's an interesting idea, and it will be a cool story for a book, because I guess nobody, there's not a lot of Friendship Island books out there, right? I mean, there's a ton of Roswell books, and there's you know. So the world doesn't really need another Roswell book, I guess, but they probably could use a Friendship Island book. But the thing is that, if I were to do that, Tim, if I were to be honest to the project, then Micah and I will need to go there. You know, it's not about just researching stuff on the internet. You know, to do an op-ed, you know, an opinion piece, an editorial about a given subject, like what I did with UFO Reframing the Debate, is one thing. But to write about something that happened or is happening in a part of the world without actually going there, I feel would be tremendously dishonest. So that's the thing, you know. I think you will need to have resources and also the time to go there and you know, do a bit of research and talk to people and try to dig up stuff. So it would be it's a difficult proposition. So so that's why it's still kind of like a pie in the sky idea.
You're sort of hitting a note that was in my head recently, in a sense, because I've been with the show winding down. I've been kind of thinking about book ideas and things like that, and it's like I think when I ever put out a book, I could see it being like different sort of chapters, and my only sort of like mission, in even you know, like I would only write the chapters. You would have to get something new out of each chapter. You know what I mean? Like I would have to go to Friendship Island. I would have to do this. I would have to, you know, talk to this specific person or something like that. Where it's like each chapter, you get something that you're going to hear or learn something new that isn't in any other book out there yet.
Well, I mean,
or you try. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I could suggest to you, you know, trying to do something of a biopic kind of piece of your own personal journey and the way that Vinyl of America changed your perception on things, you know, not just the UFOs, but maybe other stuff. So maybe you could choose from, you know, a given number of interviews and trying to explain to the audience how that affected your point of view. Because it's obvious that you are not the same Tim Binol that embarked on this journey, you know, 10 years ago. You had a different perspective. You had a different way of preconceptions about, you know, UFOs and Bigfoot and whatever. And now, you know, whether you like to admit it or not, you're one of the graybeards, you know, not because of your age, but because of the time you have been involved into all of this. And offering your perspective about that will be interesting to me.
Interesting. Thanks, man. Thanks. I'll give that thought. I'll definitely give that thought. Yeah. Well, I've noticed in sort of retrospecting on a lot of this stuff, that's like I have, I remember, like, back when I first started doing the show, people used to, like, write me, like, but what do you think? But what do you think? And now it's like, it seems like every show now I'm just going off at the mouth about what I think. And it's like, well, they must have figured out what I think by now, because I don't seem to hold anything back anymore. So I guess that's a good trait to have. All right.
Also, like you said, you know, people want the easy answers, right? They ask you, but what do you think, team? Because think, oh well, you know, if team gives me the secrets of the universe, then I don't have to do the hard work, you know, or of actually, you know, reading the books and talking to the people and going to the conferences and thinking deeply about all of this shit. You know, you have to do the legwork, right?
Yeah, and exactly.
And that's something that you could also explain to folks. Look, folks, you know, you have to reach your own conclusions because it's your journey. I mean, it's one of the few things that I wanted to share in that essay for Reframing the Debates. It's like ufology in a way has been my personal alchemy, and I'm returning to alchemy, kind of like closing the circle, the Ouroboros maybe, is that it's been a journey of transformation. It's if you start on this path and, you know, and reach the end of it, being the same person and thinking of the same things and believing the things that you believed in at the beginning, you did it wrong. You know,
yeah.
You completely missed the point of the whole experience because you it's not about reaching the answers. It's about changing yourself by the hardship of traversing the path and following the journey. And as cliche as it sounds, the journey is the destination.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I've said that on the show before, where it's like this whole thing, I mean, it's been all of America. It's just my journey of trying to, like, talk to different people and try and get my questions answered, you know?
Yeah.
And I just appreciate all the people that have been along for the ride all these years.
Yeah, and it starts very selfishly at the beginning, right? Because you started the podcast because you wanted to talk to these people. You were waiting for others to ask the questions you wanted to be asked. Since no one were doing it, they said, "Fuck it, I'll do it myself." You know, it's like Thanos. Fine, I'll do it myself. And you go and overcome your shyness and your timidity and reach out to, you know, the giants like Jim Morris and Stanton Friedman, and you realize that these people are very generous, you know, and they're very open and forthcoming, you know, to the newcomers because they were the newcomers a long, long time ago. You know, it's the same thing with each generation. And you start these very selfishly, and in a way you realize that you were not only doing it for yourself, you know, because you are also, you know, kind of like passing it along. You know, you are paying it forward for the next generation. And I wonder about the impact of all the huge archive that you are leaving behind, you know, after 10 years of talking to all these people, you know, and leaving that and the impact it will have, you know, in 10 years from now, 20, 30. You know, the impact it will have when you are not around anymore, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty awesome collection, I'll say that. You know, I'm pretty proud of it.
For sure.
It's been sometimes I hate to say it because it, like, terrifies me in a lot of ways, but, you know, we sort of joke around about this, like, when are you going to write a book and all that stuff, but it's like, this is my life's work, folks. This massive collection of interviews is my life's work. You know,
yeah.
I don't know
it's your legacy.
But it happened. So, and I can't thank you enough for being a part of it. So that's a great way to sort of wrap up the show, man. And I hope I'll see you in New Orleans next year. We're gonna have a blast, I'm sure. And it's been great. Tonight's been great talking to you. It's been great meeting you at the two events, the Paramanias, and I consider you a true friend and you know, someone whose opinion I really value and respect. And as I said, the wisdom. You know, that's why I respect it so much. I just find that you put a lot of thought into what you have to say, and it comes across in a big way when talking to you. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Sorry about the phone issues. Hopefully they weren't too bad.
No, don't worry about it, Jim. It's been great, you know, this conversation. Like, I love it when we don't know what we're going to talk about, and then, you know, we realize, holy shit, this was deep, you know, and
yeah,
that can only happen with people that you trust and that you value and that you cherish your opinions, you know, and realize, you know, it's because like you said, we are friends, you know, and sometimes I have wondered if we are, you know, we have met each other in previous reincarnations, that one of the jobs in this life for all of us, the guys that we met in Paramania and I met in the Paradigm Symposium and all of us, if one of our jobs was to re-encounter, you know,
reconnect
each other once again, you know, to reunite the family. And I really, really feel that is the case, you know. I mean, with this, fuck disclosure, man. You know,
we
have these. You know, we don't need disclosure.
Exactly. Yeah, that's for all the rest of them, man. So,
yeah.
All right, brother. Well, hopefully, I see you in New Orleans, and we'll be in touch up until then, I'm sure. So, thank you so much. And Absurd by Design is the website. Go check it out, folks, and pick up some T-shirts.
Thanks,
brother.
Bye bye.
Good night.
Bye.
There you go, folks. That was Red Pill Junkie. I love that conversation. I'm like fried. My brain is like fried from the depth. I'm like, I need to. It's not like when they bring like a submarine guy up to the surface. I have to go slowly back up to the surface. I really, really love that conversation. Next week's program, we got about 10 minutes left, but. We'll wrap it up here. Next week's show is, I think this is like the first time we've ever done this. We're actually doing a show on Halloween. So it's a Halloween night show, and it's like, it's kismet, I guess you could say. That was the word I was looking for. It's like kismet, because I was trying to get, I met Linda Godfrey at the awesome cryptozoology conference in Portland, and we talked about getting her back on the show, and I kind of was like, it'd be cool to get her on in October, because, you know, that's kind of Halloween time, you know, and a combination of her being busy and me being lazy, it's like, never really got around to trying to setting this up, and like, we couldn't really pin down a day, and then just sort of out of the blue, I was like, I don't suppose, it's kind of like crazy, but I don't suppose you're actually free like Halloween night. She's like, yeah, actually, I'm free on Halloween night. So we're doing a Halloween night show with Linda Godfrey, who put these werewolves, these bipedal canine cryptids, on the map. And she's a fantastic researcher. The topic sounds so crazy. When you meet her and talk to her, she is so down to earth and so with it and has such a tremendous perspective on this weird phenomenon, this incredibly weird phenomenon. But she has such a grounded perspective on it that it's like it really adds an air of gravitas to the whole thing. And I'm excited to bring that to folks next week on the show. And we're going to talk about her new book that came out last year. But, you know, this was a show. We barely ever get shows out as it is. We used to, at least. The new book came out last year, Monsters Among Us, An Exploration of Otherworldly Bigfoots, Wolfmen, Portals, Phantoms, and Odd Phenomena, which is perfect for Halloween night. So that's going to be next week, 9 p.m., same but all time, same but all channel. Stay tuned to the website for the linkage. Linda Godfrey, Monsters Among Us, on the next edition of the program. Thanks again to Red Pill Junkie for coming on the show, and thanks to all the folks in the chat room, and thanks to all the folks who stuck around and listened to the massive complete MP3 here. You guys are the best. Talk to you next week. Good night.